Winner to face the Columbus Crew in the semifinal round beginning in 2 weeks. Oh, it's a giveaway by Callender. Brandon Vasquez buries it. And it's history repeating itself in a horrific way for an MLS team in Monterrey.
Hello, Sunshine. I'm Alexi Lalas, and welcome to the State of the Union podcast, where we look at the beautiful game on and off the field through the lens of red, white, and blue colored glasses. This show will be talking the new romantics, U.S. women's national team champions yet again, goalkeeper redemption stories, Messi in Miami being dwarfed, the OJ Bronco chase, UCL goal fest, Suarez being Suarez, MLS's own goal, World War II in color, Club World Cup nominations, and so much more. But first, joining me as always, my friend, my colleague, my guiding light, David Mossier, soccer savant and a Fox soccer researcher and writer extraordinaire. Mossier, how you doing on this Thursday, April 11th in the year 2024?
I'm doing well. What a great idea to play the John Strong call from the Brandon Vasquez goal last night.
Yeah, we're mixing it up. You know, when you hit play on the State of the Union podcast, if you have followed us over the years, you know that we're trying some different things. And especially this week, which is going to be something that we're going to talk about. It was a monumental type of moment. And we're going to talk about that and other things, too. So we're trying some different things when it comes to the way that we give you the State of the Union. Have you watched anything, my friend?
Do you remember a show called The Regime that I mentioned a couple of weeks back?
Vaguely, starring Kate Winslet. Vaguely. You were not impressed with it. It was supposed to be comedic or at least dark a little bit, and it wasn't quite hitting the mark for you, if I remember correctly.
Correct. I thought it was 10 episodes. I was going to watch 5, and if I wasn't liking it, I was going to bail at that point. Mm-hmm. And then I came to find out it was only 6 episodes. So after I watched 5, I figured I might as well just watch the last one. Which I did a couple of days ago.
And it didn't redeem itself in the 6th, right, episode?
You know, I don't like to talk about things that I didn't like. Mm-hmm. I leave that to you. But okay. I have no choice here. This show was incomprehensibly bad.
Wow.
When you consider the pedigree in front and behind the camera, I am shocked. I was excited for this. Some of the reviews I read were positive, but no bueno.
Well, you know, I'm sure it was done with the best of intentions, and these things happen. What do I have for you? Well, I got two things. One that I actually did watch, World War II in color. I know that's a thing that you've watched before, and The Road to Victory, it's on Netflix there, and it colorizes a lot of stuff that you have seen and some stuff that you haven't seen, but it's a really good look back, a historic look back documentary on World War II, and it goes through the entire battle on both sides, and I thought it was really interesting. I thought they did a good job. I like that, what they're doing it. I know you're kind of messing with the past in terms of the colorization that goes on, but I think it was done, in this case, correctly, I guess, if it can be called correctly, and it was fun to see the footage, obviously in a very different light, literally in a different light with the color there. The other thing is, did you watch this this show a while ago? I think I asked you about The Last of Us.
I did.
I couldn't remember if you mentioned it, but it was vaguely in the back of my mind. So I was clicking through some different things, and I happened upon it. And this is where I get in trouble: is sometimes I just start something without actually going to look at it. And as anybody that has listened to the show knows, that I need to be able to binge it from start to finish. And so I watched the first episode, and I kind of got into it, zombie apocalyptic type of thing, genre out there. And then I come to find out, when I finally looked it up, which I should have done initially, that this is only the first season. There's another season that evidently is being filmed right now that will be out, I'm assuming, later on this year or next year at some time. So I'm going to have to stop watching The Last of Us because, as you know, it doesn't fill my criteria.
Sean Sullivan has raised a pretty interesting question. Do you apply this rule to movie franchises as well? Would you not watch a movie if you know that there are sequels coming?
Interesting. No, I think... Yeah. Well, back when I was growing up, back in the 1900s, back in the previous century, Mossy, while it wasn't as blatant that there were going to be multiple movies, you kind of did something and you didn't necessarily see around the corner that it was going to become a franchise. Now they plan for it and usually it happens. So, yeah, I still think that a movie in and of itself should be able to stand alone and therefore... Yeah, I mean, movies that end and it's not ending, that would drive me crazy.
You know, I am starting to employ your approach. There are two TV shows out right now, Shogun and Manhunt, that I'm very interested in. But
yeah,
in
you've
both
talked
cases,
about the Manhunt one, yeah.
Yeah, it's about the search for John Wilkes Booth after
though,
he
right?
killed Lincoln. Yeah. It's based on an excellent book that I read a few years back. But in both cases, Manhunt and Shogun, they're releasing the episodes week to week. I am waiting for all of them to drop so I can binge them. So your approach does apply to me as well sometimes.
Okay, good, good. I think it's smart. You know, I don't want to be beholden to the man or the woman out there that's putting these out. Should we light this candle?
Let's do it.
All right, where should we start?
We begin with the U.S. Women's National Team. On Tuesday night, they won the She Believes Cup by beating Canada on penalties in Columbus. It was 2-2 after 90 minutes. Adriana Leon and Sophia Smith each scoring twice. And then in the shootout, Alyssa Nair made three saves and converted her kick. This was the final match under Twyla Kilgore. Emma Hayes arrives in June. The Olympics are in July. Overall thoughts?
Overall, winning is better than losing, however it ends up happening. And this is a team that has built, let's be honest, their entire image on being champions and having that moment at the end where they are able to raise a cup and claim a title. And yet this is another one in a long list. And when they don't, it is a story in and of itself. So back to winning ways. I don't think anybody within the U.S. Women's National Team program are going to break their arms patting themselves on the back for winning the She Believes Cup. I thought it was a much more competitive type of game against Canada than certainly the last one that we saw that was underwater. And let's be honest, while this game, the rules were you went right to penalties after 90 minutes, Canada hit the crossbar right at the end of the game, and the U.S. very easily could have lost this game, but they didn't. They go into penalties, and again, we see how important Alyssa Nair is. And again, this theme that will become apparent later on in the show of goalkeepers and the redemption, because she was at fault on a goal coming out and not and failing to clear it and basically gifting Canada a goal, but she came back, not only made her penalty, but also saved penalties. And she is just, she's money. I think when you look at the old guard, she is absolutely somebody that I think is going to continue on and should continue on, and specifically because she's a goalkeeper and can do that. And you want her back there because she's... there's an argument to be made that she's the best goalkeeper in U.S. soccer history. And yet... I think that there are people that will say, yeah, but, and Hope, and Brianna, and the list goes on and on and on. But she just keeps racking up wins individually with the team. And even at a point where this team, we all know, has taken steps back, hopefully to go steps forward, she still stars.
Alyssa Nair over Hope Solo, that's a take.
It's not a crazy take out there. I think that there are certainly people out there that do it. And what Alyssa Nair suffers from, and it's not her fault, it's who she is she's not a big, over-the-top type of personality in a team that is known for huge personalities. She is very reserved. She is very quiet. She just goes about her business. And again, that's not fair to judge her on that, but certainly when you compare her to someone like Hope Solo, it's an apples and oranges type of character and personality out there. But yeah, I absolutely think that you can argue that she is the best goalkeeper in U.S. Women's National Team history.
For me, the biggest development is Jaden Shaw at the 10 with yep. three forwards in front of her. We saw that from the start against Japan and then in the second half against Canada. It'll be interesting to see if Emma Hayes buys into that as a base formation or it's only something to be used in certain situations. But wherever you put her, I said this on our last pod, I'm going to repeat it. It's becoming harder and harder to justify a U.S. lineup without Jaden Shaw in it.
Or a U.S. lineup with Alex Morgan in it. Can you justify that lineup?
It's increasingly tough if Macario and Swanson recover their pre-injury form.
Yeah. Champagne problems, as we said last show, this is all good stuff. And I do think that, you know, in this age where now we've seen multiple assistant coaches take these teams, whether it's the men's team or the national team, handing it off in a better situation than before, I think is your job and your responsibility. And again, we don't know how much Emma Hayes has been influencing it, but she has to have been influencing from the outside. But well done to Twyla. Thank you for your work. And now she hands it off to Emma, and it's her responsibility going forward, starting with the Olympics.
She's the female BJ Callahan.
Exactly. Who evidently is not in his job anymore over there in Saudi Arabia or wherever he was.
Yeah. Incidentally.
Oh, sorry. No, that was Anthony Hudson. Anthony Hudson, excuse me.
Yeah. Corbin Albert came on for Jaden Shaw in the 75th minute. Remember, this is a player who started 5 of the 6 matches at the Gold Cup, played very well, and has continued to play well for her club team, PSG. She didn't start either game in the She Believes Cup. It defies credulity to think that it was purely tactical. It obviously had something to do with the social media controversy. I think Twyla Kilgore felt like it was best for everyone involved if she took a back seat in these two games, but I think this will all blow over by June and July, and Emma Hayes will be able to pick her team based purely on soccer reasons. And then Corbin Albert becomes an interesting part of this equation because she was an emerging star in the midfield. And so if you play Jaden Shaw as a 10, you have to lose one of your midfielders. So how you fit that puzzle could be fascinating.
You know, this is why Emma's being paid the big bucks, is to figure out how to fit all of this on the field. And look, it can only be 11. We've talked about this with the men's national team. When you start taking out some of these pieces, what ends up happening is, yeah, you're kicking yourself for not being able to have some of this talent on the field. But the other side of it is depth. And the other side of it is when things go wrong, and as good as this U.S. team, I think, can be, there will be moments when it goes wrong and Emma has to fix it. She can look down the bench and she can have some quality going in. But this type of competition for spots is a good thing. This type of reset for this team with all of these players and many of them that we're talking about that haven't been there before or have had very limited time with this national team, these are all good things. I, you know, out with the old, except for Lissonnaire, and in with the new.
We also found out that Zambia will be the third team in the U.S.'s Olympic group, along with Germany and Australia. So we now know the 3 group games the U.S. will play at the Olympics.
Is that the order of games, too? So we face Zambia first or whatever?
Zambia is the opening game, yes.
All right. So, I mean, that's a good, it's a good team to face at the beginning of the Olympics. But this is, you know, this is a group this is a group in the Olympics that will test this new U.S. women's national team. And again, as I said before, while I want to win championships and I want to be, you know, holding the trophy, whether it's a big tournament or a small tournament, I think there have to be bigger fish to fry, and you have to see the long term. And that long term is ultimately getting back and winning a World Cup for Emma relative to what we see in the Olympics this summer. All right, so successful, and congratulations to this group on winning yet another one. This is, how many have they won? They probably won a bunch of them, right? All right.
Yes. Well. Next up, the CONCACAF Champions Cup. The semifinals are set. We began this edition with 10 MLS teams and 6 Liga MX, and it's 3-1 Liga MX in the semis. We covered all 4 quarterfinal second legs this week on FS1. Let's go through each of them individually, and then we'll circle back to some big picture talking points. Club America,
okay,
after beating New England 4-0 at Gillette, hammered them again 5-2 at the Azteca to complete a 9-2 aggregate triumph. The good news from an American point of view, Alex Zendejas has scored in both legs. He's playing very well right now, but a pretty embarrassing showing by the Revs.
The Revs aren't a good team, okay? Whether it's internationally or in MLS, they're not a good team right now. It remains to be seen if they can be better, but this was a complete and utter failure for the New England Revolution relative to CONCACAF Champions Cup.
Pachuca beat Herediano 2-1 at home to complete a 7-1 aggregate triumph. So one semifinal will be Pachuca against America. All the drama this week was on the other side of the bracket. First, the good from an MLS perspective. Tigres Columbus, they had played to a 1-1 draw in Ohio. They played to another 1-1 draw in Mexico with the same goal scorers, Gignac and Rossi. The Gignac goal came thanks to a horrific mistake by Columbus goalkeeper Patrick Schulte, but we eventually went to penalties and Schulte redeemed himself, denying Gignac and Guido Pizarro the crew advance.
Okay, so first I'm going to start with the overall positive of this. You are looking at arguably the best team in Major League Soccer, coached by the best coach, arguably, in Major League Soccer, in Wilfred Nancy. And so that they found a way through says a lot about how good they are, and I think justifies a lot of the way that we look at the Columbus Crew going forward. And now all of these eggs, from an MLS perspective, are in this basket. But this is a pretty good basket to put your eggs in when you're talking about quality and when you're talking about balance of a team. This particular game was nuts, and it went the entire spectrum of emotions and performances. You mentioned Schulte, and this gets back to, you know, again, these goalkeepers that throughout the game have moments of great success and great failure. And starting off not being good. And Patrick Schulte, all right, you make a mistake. And to his credit, and to Wilfred Nancy's credit, because he talked about it after the game, he understood, and everybody understood, that this was a mistake that could become the defining moment of the game, if you let it. And yet they had the fortitude, built over time, and the confidence that has been instilled in them individually and collectively, to push on. So much so that I ultimately think Columbus was the better team in that game. Now, it took them a while to get there. This does go back to something bigger picture that we've talked about before, Mossy, in the world in which we live in the soccer world in which we live in, and how much it has evolved over time, or quote unquote evolved. And this is, you know, I called it, you know, the new romantics. And whether it's the players or whether it's the coaches or whether it's even the fans out there, this expectation of playing out of the back. And again, I have no problem playing out of the back. Some of the most beautiful soccer can be accomplished by successfully playing out of the back. And I fully recognize that the risks and the reward equation is drastically different than when I was playing. People do things nowadays in soccer, as I said before, that you would be fired on the spot for doing back in my day. However, if you are playing out of the back, you are taking risks that haven't been taken in the past in order to gain the benefits, fine. But if you are unable to do so, and if you want to die on that hill, which is what we saw numerous times yesterday, I think it is problematic. And I think it comes from coaching in saying, yes, I want you to do this. And yes, you can blame me. All right, fine. If you are the coach, whether it's Wilfred Nancy or Tata Martino or anybody else out there, and you are telling your team, this is how we are going to play come hell or high water, then you have to accept the responsibility that your players are going to do that. And if and when it happens that they are not able to do so in the most important point, then it is on you. And Wilfred Nancy can sit back and say, yeah, but this is how we do it. And I am a romantic. And this is what I believe is in good soccer. And I would rather lose playing like this than win being rudimentary and being caveman-esque and kicking the ball away and living to fight another day. And that's why I get frustrated at times. I know I was sitting next to Rob Stone and Stu Holden. At times, it's incredibly frustrating because you are trying to be something that you are not. I'm not saying in the future you can't be that, but right now you're not, and you're not doing what is right in that moment for what the game needs. How am I wrong, Moss?
I agree with you. I've always interpreted playing out of the back as if you have a choice between going long and going short, you choose to go short. But sometimes there is no choice. Everybody's short is covered. And this idea that you have to force it come hell or high water, I don't agree with. We've even seen Pep Guardiola manage Manchester City, not be above Ederson sending a long ball to the strikers if that's the right play in that situation. So yeah, some of the decision-making we saw the last couple of days, I agree with you, was head-scratching.
But I don't blame the players. And yet, I'm kind of jealous. I would love to have been given that autonomy. I would love to have been given that freedom to be able to play out of the back in these risky type of situations. But again, the coaches are saying, this is how we have to play. And maybe Schulte or others that we're going to talk about, or even a listener, whoever, maybe in that moment, the seed has been planted and they know, you know what? I have to find a way to get out of this position. And they believe that I can get out of this position. I have to play that small thing. I have to pull a Cruyff in my 6-yard box if I'm a goalkeeper. I have to do that. Well, then it is on the coaches. And if and when it happens, we shouldn't blame the players. You know, what the coaches are going to do is say, yes, but I give them the responsibility because I believe that they can do it. And too often, I think what we're seeing, again, is players and teams saying we are at a certain level when they are not even close to being on that level, because that's what we equate with real football. That's what we equate with sexy football. That's what we create with we equate with romantic football. I can't believe you got me to say football. All is lost.
I will say, if you analyze these two legs in their totality, Columbus was good value for their advancement. They played well. But what gave it an air of fortune was some of the chances that Tigres missed in the first half of that second leg. The Crew were all over the place defensively, bad giveaways, poorly executed offside traps. And we're so accustomed to seeing MLS teams get punished in Mexico for that. It was pretty unbelievable that they got to halftime only down 1-0, and then they were able to improve from there.
But they found a way through. And that is the mark of a good team. Obviously, they needed penalties. A lot of people wanted to remind me. I was getting texts about how MLS Next Pro has used penalties as the deciding factor when there are ties. And so there's a generation of MLS Next Pro players that are coming up that have had many more opportunities to be in situations where they are hitting penalties. And I've said before, it is not a coin toss. It is not a flip of a coin. It is not a crapshoot. It is a skill and an art. And ultimately, Columbus were much better. And redemption time, Schulte comes to the rescue.
For about 24 hours there, MLS fans got their swagger back because Columbus went through. You had a motivated Messi facing Monterrey. And you thought, well, if they move on, then it's 2-2 in the semis and it would guarantee an MLS finalist. So this whole negative MLS narrative would go away, but it was not to be because Inter Miami laid an absolute egg in Monterrey. They had lost the first leg 2-1. They lost the second leg 3-1. Brandon Vasquez scored the first goal, taking advantage of a horrific giveaway by Drake Callender. So you'll have occasion to go on the same rant again.
It's the same thing. Just plug in Drake Callender, plug in Inter Miami, plug in Tata Martino. But ultimately, they didn't win. And so this was the beginning of the end.
Then Bertarami and Gallardo scored in the second half. Diego Gomez pulled one back late. For all the talk about poking the bear and Messi's going to have fire in his eyes, he wandered around completely disinterested. It was one of the worst matches I've ever seen him play. Suarez wasn't much better. Jordi Alba got himself sent off. So a terrible night for Inter Miami.
Well, it just confirms that there is a difference between poking a bear and poking a dwarf, right? So this is a situation where Messi and company didn't show up. And the field wasn't good. I get that, but that's not an excuse. All right, but they better get their crap together down there because 2026 is coming, and that is a venue for 2026. And it was, you know, it was all over the place. You could tell it was very, very soft, but it was the same for both teams. I thought the beginning of the game, Inter Miami was completely in control, certainly of possession, but they weren't creating a whole lot. There weren't a lot of moments of magic from Messi. He had one opportunity that you would bet he would have gotten at least on goal, and he sailed it over the top. But this was an Inter Miami that did not collectively or individually, in some of the stars that we have, show up in the most important moment. And again, time and time again, if you look at these goals, this Inter Miami team playing out of the back. And I said on air, there are some Barcelona legends on this team, Inter Miami. But this is not Barcelona. And yet, again, the risky passes. And if you're Monterrey, you're looking around going, yeah, we'll take this, no problem. You want to give us this gift? You want to play these risky passes out? Fine. Not only will we eat that up, but we'll eat it up in dangerous areas, and then we will make you pay. And so consistently and unnecessarily shooting themselves in the foot when it comes to Miami from a playing out of the back perspective and then not creating anything up top.
All right, so big picture, we've had 14 matches in this edition of the CONCACAF Champions Cup between League MX and MLS teams. MLS has not won a single one. 9 wins and 5 draws for League MX. They've outscored MLS 33-10 in those games. They prevailed in 6 of the 7 two-legged ties. The only exception being Columbus, who advanced on penalties after a pair of draws. So that's leading to a lot of hand-wringing today, a lot of discussion. Tata Martino said after last night's match, until MLS relaxes its many roster rules in order to build more robust squads where player absences, injury suspensions aren't as difficult to overcome, Liga MX will have an advantage. Henry Bushnell wrote an article today on Yahoo to that effect. You talked about it last night. So what are your thoughts?
Okay, so, you know, we talked about the fact that MLS plays with one foot behind their back. And everybody understands this. Tata, everybody understands this. I would love to change it. I love to spend other people's money. We all love to tell rich people how to spend their money, especially when it comes to a game entertainment that is soccer. But it is a reality. And again, you're not telling the MLS owners anything that they don't know. But When it comes to, for example, last night, when Brandon Vasquez scores a goal. Now, Brandon Vasquez is an MLS killer, all right? So he's gone through Cincinnati. Now he's gone through Miami, and there's a possibility he could go through Columbus. This is a player that did not want to go and play in Liga MX. That wasn't his ultimate goal. He wanted to stay. He was a talented player in Major League Soccer. He was a star. Commissioner Don Garber for years has talked about MLS being a league of choice. Well, if MLS is to be a league of choice, it not only has to be a league of choice of talent coming in from the outside, but talent has to be rewarded and accommodated that choose MLS from the inside. And that's what Brandon Vasquez was. But because of the mechanisms, because of the restrictions, because of the reality, and by the way, the reality that has made it the most successful American professional soccer league in history, but because of that reality, Brandon Vasquez is now taking down MLS teams. MLS has become the architect of their demise. And so it's on them. They have no one to blame but themselves. They could change it overnight if they wanted to. They don't want to. And fine, that is their business decision. But they will continue to not fight on an even playing field. And so Tata Martino is absolutely right. And in the past, we've just said, well, that's no excuse. Find a way to get it done. And that's what Wilfred Nancy has done. But think of, as well as they have done, given all the challenges, think if they were actually given the opportunity to have an equal playing field. My goodness, that would be wonderful to see. But they don't want to do it. And it's on them.
Although, news this week coming out of the MLS Board of Governors meetings, they approved some changes. The relaxing of restrictions on the combined number of designated players and under 22 initiative signings, doubling in the number of contract buyouts allowed per season, and increasing the amount of general allocation money teams receive when players are transferred out of the league. So there is some movement on that front.
It's great. It's still too complicated. Just let people spend what they want. And let's go on. Have a floor, have a ceiling if you want. And the real problem with MLS right now is that Tata Martino said this, is that it's top heavy. And Columbus has actually done a better job of spreading it out. Now, I know it's not as sexy when it comes to signing big names, but when you have your designated players and you're paying them all this money, and then the rest of the team isn't making even close to that amount of money. That's a problem for MLS from a business structure standpoint, but obviously it impacts the competitive side on the field right now. And again, we're telling people how to spend their money out there and the success that they have had. But it goes back to what I said about 2026 and wanting to do big, bold things. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the show.
Yeah, we got an Ask Alexi question about the Club World Cup next year, and the U.S. by hosting it gets an extra spot, and who might that go to? So I have a feeling we'll bring up Inter Miami again in that discussion down there. But they now have to turn the page to MLS. They really wanted to win this CONCACAF Champions Cup because of that berth to the Club World Cup. So you wonder where they are mentally now, where they do have Leagues Cup later in the year, but for now it's just a slog of the MLS regular season. This upcoming weekend, they are away to SKC.
They evidently are going directly to Kansas City, and SKC is playing this game in, what's the football stadium there that I used to play in?
Arrowhead?
Arrowhead, yes. My goodness, I can't believe I forgot that. So they've, you know, Messi's coming into town. They can sell a lot of tickets. They can make a big deal about it. However, oh, by the way, Tata Martino, you didn't make a single sub last night. Everybody's waiting for you to do something. You didn't do anything. You just folded your arms and said, this is it. And he just kept everybody playing out there. And so now Messi has played midweek after travel on a very soft field. It would not surprise me in the least if come Saturday or Sunday, was the game Saturday, Sunday? But anyway, this weekend over at Arrowhead, that the good folks of Kansas City are not given the treat that they all paid for, which was to see arguably the greatest player in the world play the game, Saturday game.
Now, in your opening, when you teased all the topics we were going to discuss, you did mention Luis Suarez. I blew past that. Do we want to discuss his petulance last night?
The problem is it's Luis Suarez, and Suarez is going to Suarez, right? And for those that didn't see, there was a moment in last night's game that I cannot believe for the life of me was not reviewed. Well, it probably was reviewed by VAR, and then just said, well, it's Suarez and it's a different grading structure. But what it looked like to me was Suarez grabbed the defender's arm in the box and tried to rip it off. It was very, very, well, it's very, very strange if you're not Luis Suarez. But you know, when Luis Suarez is into the game and he's scoring and he's being dangerous and he surprisingly has been very much that in MLS so far, that's great. But it just takes a second for that dude to click and he just does some very, very bizarre stuff. And he was lucky to continue on the field last night.
Ivan Barton was strangely subdued last night. He was the referee in that match. He's known for allowing his matches to descend into chaos and over-refereeing and pulling out red cards at every turn. Don't you agree that last night he was weirdly calm and trying to
He was just zen, recognizing that there was possibility of the the crazy Messi showing up and all that kind of stuff. So
one last thing before we move on. We showed footage of David Beckham at a Monterey restaurant getting absolutely mobbed.
Yep.
And I was discussing this with our boss, Zach Kenworthy. Could you argue that in Messi and David Beckham, Inter Miami have two of the five most famous sportsmen in the world right now?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, I mean, and if you look at the most famous people in the world, it would be interesting if you put together a list out there. And we've talked about, you know, the Donald Trumps and stuff like that, but Messi for sure would be in that top 10. I would think, yeah.
And that line outside the Inter Miami Hotel to get a glimpse at Messi that we showed.
It's a show, man. It is a show. And people want to see it. We talked about it on the show last night about, you know, we're just coming off this Caitlin Clark stuff and what was his name? Prime, Dion and stuff like that. As I said before, the only reason that I watched women's basketball was because of Caitlin Clark. The only reason why many people are going to these games is to see Messi. He transcends the sport. He brings people into the tent. And he is looked at as a god everywhere that he goes. And so this type of reception, and David Beckham obviously is a and has been a name for decades now in not just soccer world, but in celebrity world. So it's no surprising. And it is kind of like a world tour of the biggest band in the world when Inter Miami now goes domestically or internationally.
Made me think of the last dance of Chicago Bulls during Michael Jordan's last season. Every city they went to, it was crazy.
Any other MLS games you want to highlight?
So I should say Inter Miami away at SKC, and Sean Sullivan did put in the run on at Arrowhead, and we both somehow missed that. So
there he goes. Him, yeah, we should probably read his rundown every once in a while.
One more game to mention. Top of the table clash in the West. Vancouver will host the Galaxy. The Galaxy looking to bounce back from that El Tráfico defeat.
And Vancouver coming off a big win last weekend, so they're feeling good right there. Shout out also to the New York Red Bulls, and they're sitting top of the East over there, and really, I guess, kind of quietly given what they are. They host Chicago, and so they could continue on. I think a couple of shows ago, I said I'm not quite yet ready to anoint them and give them elite status. But they keep going the way they're going, and that's good news for the red side of New York over there. All right, but anyway, there'll be a lot of MLS stuff going on this weekend. I'll be sitting in front of my MLS 360 watching, as we talked about last show.
Adam Inman, a colleague of ours at Fox, who's a big Galaxy fan and an avid listener of this pod, he was appalled by your take on the Bouanga penalty last week. He couldn't believe it.
He thought it was a dive?
Correct.
Yeah. Whatever. I mean, we talked about it before. Adam's a good man, but he's, delusional. All right, what now?
That is it.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, some Champions League action. Goals galore. I'm going with it. Okay, welcome back. There was all sorts of action when it comes to UEFA Champions League, Mossy. Where to start? Goals galore.
Yeah, the quarterfinals are off and running. It was an incredible couple of days. Let's begin Tuesday at the Emirates. Arsenal-Bayern Munich finished 2-2. Saka scored first for the Gunners. Then Gnabry made it 1-1. Harry Kane from the penalty spot 2-1. And then in the second half, two subs combined. Jesus to Trossard 2-2. Some controversy at the end. Let's go there first. Saka, Neuer, did you think that was a penalty?
He drags the leg, right? Is that what we're screaming and yelling about here? Is that what the situation is?
Correct.
Yeah, I think he drags the leg in an unnatural, in an unnatural way, okay? Again, as I said before many times, it's not his responsibility to avoid contact. It's not his responsibility to take a different route. It's not his responsibility to jump over a leg. But it's one thing to go to feel it, and good players feel it. It's another thing to actually kind of kick out, and in doing so, initiate the contact there. Because whether it's Neuer or anybody else, players that are defending, they have a right to occupy a space. And when you, in this instance, then encroach in on their space, I think it completely changes the dynamic and the complexion of what you're calling there. So yeah, I thought it was a little bit much. But I don't blame him for doing it.
Yeah, I do not think it was a penalty at all. I thought Saka kicked Neuer. So to me, when you saw the replay, it wasn't even debatable.
But did you think that the result ultimately was fair?
Yes.
Really?
Of the match overall?
Yeah. I thought Bayern was better. If I'm Bayern, I'm saying we let one get away here.
Yeah, perhaps. Arsenal got off to a good start. Saka made it 1-0. Ben White should have made it 2-0. And then a mistake by Gabriel, which led to the Gnabry goal, really turned the tide. Arsenal never recaptured the fluency they had in those first 15 minutes or so. Bayern could feel like they should have won that game. They had an incredible chance late with Coman hitting the post.
Oh, my God.
So now we go back to Munich. I still think this is a 50-50. I think Arsenal are very capable of going there and getting a result. Do you lean Bayern at all, or you say 50-50?
I lean Bayern, yeah. I think that while they will feel that they lost one there, I think that Bayern just has this aura, and it's got to have been stoked up from a forgettable league season. And talk about putting all eggs in one basket. This is it. And they're still really good. And yeah, so I'm going to go with Bayern on this one.
Also on Tuesday, Real Madrid and Manchester City played to a 3-3 draw. Lots of fireworks early. Bernardo Silva with a cheeky free kick got past Lunin, 1-0 City. Then Camavinga took a shot that deflected off Ruben Diaz, 1-1. And then Vinicius to Rodrigo on the break, 2-1 Real Madrid. This was all in the first 15 minutes. Then in the second half, two incredible strikes by Foden and Vardy made it 3-2 City, but a beautiful Valverde volley made it 3-3.
Yeah, this had everything. You mentioned the Gvardiol goal. I mean, he's never going to hit that again, and he was as surprised as anybody there. Some wonderful goals, some suspect goals. Did you think who's at fault on the free kick goal? The wall, the goalkeeper.
Yeah, I think
you said you called it cheeky.
Yes, I think the wall needed to be set up better.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's inexcusable for something like that to happen. And they should all be ashamed that they get paid money to actually play professional soccer.
A few thoughts on this one. Manchester City is the better team. The fact that Real Madrid played on the counter the whole time is evidence of that. But I will say there was a middle chunk of this game, last 20 minutes or so, the first half, first 15 minutes of the second half, when it was 2-1 Real Madrid, and they had all the best chances. City really played with fire there. On a different day where Real Madrid had their finishing boots on, they could have broken that open, gone up like 4-1, and then that would have been a big hill to climb for Manchester City. So I do think they dodged the bullet there, and they ended up getting a pretty good result in the end.
It was, I mean, from a neutral standpoint, it's fun because it's a lot of goals, and it's back and forth, and there's no real defense, and there's no real rhyme or reason to it. I'm sure whether, you know, it doesn't matter. Either side probably looked at it when they're going to look at it this week and say that's not necessarily that we want to do or something that we can count on going forward. But I'm still going to go ultimately with City. But it's amazing, so, you know, some of these teams that we hold and put on a pedestal and they, you know, all of the technique and the tactics and stuff like that, when it ends up being kind of like a street ball type of game like that, we go, this is great. But there's no way that these coaches drew it up like this.
No, yeah. A couple of thoughts on City. One good, one bad. The good, Phil Foden has leveled up this season and is now one of the best players in the world. He had a shot minutes before his goal from that same spot that he shot right at Lunin, and it felt like a golfer taking a practice swing. You knew if he got another chance from there, it was going to go in the upper corner, and it did. What a sensational goal from him.
Do you think it's just a logical type of progression and evolution for him, or is it something that has happened? I mean,
it's interesting because he stuck it out there through some years where he wasn't playing as much as people wanted him to, while others like Sancho and Cole Palmer decided they didn't want to wait and left City at an early age to go somewhere else. So it's interesting the different paths you can take, and for Foden, you have to say, it's now paying off because he's reaching his full potential.
But you look at him as one of the elites in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, okay. He's incredible. And then on the downside, Erling Haaland. I think everybody right now is struggling to reconcile this. Look, goals win games. And when you have a guy that is as adept at scoring it as he is, he's obviously a valuable commodity, but he's so limited and it gets exposed in some of these games that can we really consider this guy one of the handful best players in the world?
What do you mean he's limited in that he's predictable?
Yeah, and he's just so reliant on service. You know, you have all these other players in the field that you see can conjure up things on their own. Well, you know, Haaland, if you don't get him the ball in his spots, you know, that's he barely touches it and you don't even notice he's out there.
But this should not have come as a surprise to anybody. I mean, it's not like he's forgotten to do it. And to your point, I can agree, because when you talk about, you know, look at some comps out there, Lewandowski, even he, who is certainly reliant on service, he does some individual things that you say, all right, well, that's something that Erling Haaland hasn't. And I'm not saying that Erling Haaland hasn't had individual moments. Sometimes he'll get out in open space and he'll be able to take players on one-on-one, and that's something doing alone. But I understand what you're saying, but you're giving up on him?
No, I just think he's a specialist. Like, I'm trying to reconcile the fact that I can both think he's going to be the best center forward in the world for the next 10 years, but there's never going to be a day that I'm going to think he's the best player in the world, because I'm just always partial to somebody that's got a bit more to his game and is creative. And so that's just how I view these goal-scoring center forwards. I don't know. I mean, is that crazy?
It's not crazy, but I think what you've reconciled is that this is who he is. So there's no change or growth. He can't be something that he's not, and you don't see him having something else.
I don't know, because there was one match late last season against Arsenal at home where his link-up play was excellent. He was skipping around defenders, so he has it in him. It's one game, but nevertheless, that one game is stuck in my head, and it makes me think that there is more to his game if he wanted to really develop it. So I don't know. We'll see.
Boy, Mossy wants more from him. I can appreciate that, because it'd be easy to just say, well, this is who he is, and either you like him or you don't, but that's it. He's never going to get any better. But you believe there's still an opportunity for him to be better.
As for the second leg, Kevin De Bruyne did not play due to illness, and Kyle Walker did not play due to injury. They're both expected back at the Etihad next week. So I think Edge, Manchester City, I expect them to go through.
Yeah, especially with a non-puking Kevin De Bruyne. That'll be a good thing.
You know, when the lineup sheet came out and I saw that De Bruyne wasn't in it, you know how Pep can sometimes overthink these big games.
It did actually
cross my mind that he had just left him out. But then I checked on X and saw that he was ill.
Oh my God, that would have been nuts. Where to now?
We go to Wednesday, where we had another great game. Barcelona with a 3-2 away win over PSG at the Parc des Princes. Rafinha scored in the first half. Then PSG scored twice early in the second half. Then Bale and Vicinha. But then Barcelona, a sensational goal to make it 2-2. The pass from Pedri and the volley from Rafinha, and then Christensen off a corner, 3-2. So a great result for them. They are in the driver's seat to advance.
Okay, so what kind of nuttiness is this, Mossy? How is this possible that Barcelona is able to conjure up this type of performance? Everything that we have said about that, what they are, more importantly, what they aren't in this version of it. And not only that, but in Paris against PSG. How is that possible?
You know, with Barcelona doing what they're doing since Xavi announced he's leaving, and even the Bayern result with Tuchel in the same boat, my dad joked with me that this is the departing manager bounce.
We don't have to really listen to the dude anymore because he's going anyway, so we'll just do what we want.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
And, you know, speaking of managers, Luis Enrique, in his press conference before this match, he was asked, who embodies Barcelona's spirit and identity more, you or Xavi? And everybody expected him to give some diplomatic answer, and he said, me, without question.
I love it. I love
but then
it.
They were hugging before the game, so I don't think Xavi took it in a bad way.
It's fine. I mean, you know, ultimately, we got not the last laugh, but certainly this laugh here today. So now what happens in the return?
I think Barcelona go through. I will say, Mbappe was oddly subdued in that first leg, did not play well. We know he's leaving in the summer. He had kind of a LeBron game 5 against the Celtics in 2010 kind of vibe to him. I don't know what that
so
was
you're
about.
You're going to bet on him not returning to form?
Well, they certainly need him in the second. Like, I saw a great post on X. If you had told me that there were going to be 18 goals in the Champions League this week and Mbappe and Haaland would not score a single one of them, right, you wouldn't have believed it.
I'm still going to stick with PSG. All right. And then finally...
Atletico Madrid claimed a 2-1 home win over Dortmund. They scored early when Kobel and Mattson made a mess out of playing out of the back. Rodrigo De Paul capitalized. So it doesn't just happen in CONCACAF. We see it in UEFA as well.
Listen, the new romantic effect is all over. It is global. Everybody wants to be a part of it.
And then Samuel Lino made it 2-0. And Atletico had chances to break this wide open. They didn't take advantage, and then they got punished for it late. Sebastian Haller made it 2-1, and Julian Brandt actually hit the woodwork in stoppage time, so it was almost 2-2. But Dortmund, with that Haller goal, still very much in this tie.
But you think Dortmund is still in this?
I think Dortmund is still in this, but Atletico will go through.
Yeah, me too. I agree with you there. What else? Do we got any Europa action?
Yes, some terrific quarterfinal first legs this week in that competition as well. Roma went to the San Siro and beat AC Milan 1-0. Mancini with the goal in the first half. Pulisic started. Musa, an unused sub.
Oof. Well, that's not good for AC Milan and Christian Pulisic. Pulisic got a yellow 2, and not good for Musa there, but great for Mancini to get that big, big goal.
And Roma continued their resurgence under De Rossi, who's been a big improvement over Jose Mourinho. I know the Mourinho fanboys don't want to hear that, but...
It's like night and day, right?
Yes. And you know who's happy with this result?
Who's that?
Jack, apparently, is a Roma fan who works on our pod. I just found that out today.
He's been keeping this quiet. Yes. And he came in today, and he was screaming and yelling, so... Interesting. Well, I mean, his perfect day would be Roma winning, but Christian Pulisic playing and doing well. That's usually how it goes.
And Michigan doing something. Remember, he's a big Michigan fan. That's how him and I bond.
Michigan being docked points for doing something illegal. Yes.
Michigan actually played tonight in the Frozen Four, so Jack does have something to watch.
Right.
The hockey equivalent of the Final Four.
Any other Europa stuff?
Yes. Atalanta went to Anfield and smacked Liverpool around 3-0. Scamacca with 2 goals. I'm reading Keith Costigan's post on X. I've never seen him go after Klopp like this. We were out-coached. Wrong lineup, bad subs. Keith is beside himself.
Really?
Yeah.
He's all over Klopp?
Yeah.
I thought Klopp was untouchable.
Yep.
Evidently not. Well, I mean, they just got their ass handed to. Wow. That is amazing. Now, how does this affect big picture quotient and all that kind of stuff? Is this possibly impact this?
Yes. If Atalanta were to eliminate Liverpool, that would be a big feather in Serie A's cap. They're in good shape to get that fifth place to be a Champions League berth, which could be good news for Sean Sullivan's Bologna or Jack's Roma. They're both in that mix.
Thanks, Klopp.
Yes. Leverkusen incidentally scored twice late to beat West Ham 2-0 at home, and Benfica beat Marseille 2-1. In terms of the weekend in Europe, let's go to the Premier League, the title race there. Manchester City will host Luton Town, Liverpool will host Crystal Palace, and Arsenal will host Aston Villa. So they're all at home. Arsenal have the toughest game of the three.
I mean, yeah, so much so. I mean, you got to feel that Pep's going to rest some players against Luton, I would think.
I would think so, yes.
Right? All right, yeah, I don't... Yeah, so who Liverpool, you think, has the... Wait, you said Liverpool has the most difficult?
Arsenal has the most difficult.
Aston Villa. Yeah. I still think they all find ways through.
I agree. I think all three win this weekend. We dropped down a level to the championship. We had some midweek action. Norwich played to a 2-2 draw away to Jonty Whitehead's Sheffield Wednesday. Josh Sargent with a goal in that one. While Coventry suffered a 2-1 defeat away to Southampton. Haji Wright missed a penalty in that game.
Oh, no. That's not good. But it is good for Josh Sargent. I mean, I don't want to be blasé that we just constantly, seems like every week you're talking about Josh Sargent scoring another goal. This is wonderful. I mean, he is a goal scorer, but he's improved. And the consistency in which he's scoring, again, just irritates me that he was hurt this last window. But I would love to see him this summer and see what this new version of him looks like in the national team.
The center forward battle for the U.S. is so interesting. Last night, we did Monterrey Inter Miami. I could not help but watch Brandon Vasquez through that lens and analyze his movements and how it would compare to the other center forwards in the mix and how he would gel with Pulisic, Reina, and company. So, you know, you can't help but think that
way. Do some reality show. Just bring them all in and let's just see what happens. And yes, the best man standing.
So Norwich, 5 points clear of Coventry for that last promotion playoff spot in this upcoming weekend. Norwich away to Preston, Coventry away to Birmingham. Finally, we mentioned that Leverkusen beat West Ham today in the Europa League. They're still unbeaten in all competitions this season. And this upcoming weekend, they can wrap up their first ever Bundesliga title. They host Werder Bremen. If they win, they are the champions.
It's April 11th. We're going to have a champion.
Incredible.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
The last time somebody other than Bayern Munich won the Bundesliga title, it was Borussia Dortmund in the 2011-12 campaign. They clinched it in April of 2012. And just to put that into some perspective, in April of 2012, Sean Sullivan and Kat were still college students at Tennessee. Aaron Schechter was like 12 or 13 years old preparing for her bat mitzvah. So long time ago.
Wow. That is a long time. What year did you say that was?
2012.
I was still, gosh, where was I? I was still at ESPN getting ready for, I guess, I don't know, maybe a Euros or something like that. I don't know. All sorts of stuff was going on back then. Doesn't seem that long ago. It really wasn't that long ago. Anything else, my friend?
And that is it.
All right, let's take another quick break. When we come back, it's time for Ask Alexi. Okay, welcome back. It's time for Ask Alexi, that part of the show where you send in your comments, questions, and concerns. And you can do it on the social media platforms out there. And keep in mind that our handle is SOTU with Alexi, and use that hashtag Ask Alexi. Or you can call into our State of the Union podcast hotline, which is 657-549-2297, 657-549-2297. Mossy, what do the folks want to know today?
First up, a voicemail. Let's take a listen right now.
Hey, Alexi and Mossy, it's Josh from Atlanta. Hey, love the pod. So Mossy's probably heard about the College Football Super League they're talking about proposing. I only bring this up because the MLS guys, they're working with MLS guys to build a similar model where the schools own the league, like the kind of like the teams own the league in MLS. And one of the really interesting things about this College Football Super League that I think translates possibly to the MLS is they're talking about having, like, most of the teams can't get relegated. But there's a couple spots each year that the lower division can, they can come up and some of these schools that are up can go down. My question for you guys is, do you think this is something that could maybe work in the MLS? Like, we have 30 teams, they're locked in, but the MLS buys the USL or buys the second division, whatever, and then one or two teams come up each year. Is there any possibility of that working? I know it's not like anything in the world that exists, but I thought it was an interesting idea, and would love to hear you guys' take on it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Josh from Atlanta. Mossy, can you just distill it down a little bit so I understand my little brain as it relates to this football possibility and translating it to a soccer situation?
So a lot of people think the NCAA is no longer equipped to run college football.
Okay.
So the school.
Are you one of those people?
I have a lot of issues with the NCAA.
Okay, yeah.
Particularly in their handling of sign-stealing controversy. So the idea is all the schools would band together and they would create this super league and they would have different tiers, and there would be 70 schools that would be guaranteed to always be in the first tier, but then there would be another 50 or so that could get promoted and relegated between the first tier and the second tier. And the teams in the first tier would be divided into divisions, and then depending on how you fare in those divisions, you advance the playoffs. So they would basically organize themselves and render the NCAA obsolete.
Okay, so I certainly don't know a whole lot about the football situation, but when it comes to the NCAA, from what I see and what I feel and what I sense is, to your point, it is heading in the direction of being irrelevant. And so there is absolutely a case to be made for something new and improved, quote-unquote, better, to come along and take the place, given all the changes and the dramatic changes that we have seen over there in college sports. As it relates to how, American soccer, and in this case, you're talking about MLS, you even mentioned coming together with USL. I've talked a long time about, this ramp up to 26 and the opportunity and the moment that soccer has in the United States, and we'll throw Canada in too, and Mexico, for that matter, relative to 2026. But this moment to do things and to big, bold, dare I say, arrogant things. Because if you're not going to do it now, then when? Go big or go home relative to 26. And this applies to anybody in the soccer space out there. When it comes to a potential league like this, A lot of people out there, a lot of zealots out there when it comes to promotion relegation will argue, well, this is just intra-league promotion relegation and it's a bastardized version, but at least it's something. I do think that at some point, all of these teams, and obviously next year MLS will become 30 teams. If you were to add all the USL teams, it would be this this Goliath of a league. You would have to find something to separate out the different divisions. And you know, possibly to incorporate it. But the way you're explaining it to me, not there are certain protections. And I know when the original Super League idea came out, there were going to be these untouchable types of teams. I think that's hard. I think it's hard to split that baby, if you will, and have teams that are protected. But the argument is the only way this gets done if people do insulate and protect themselves, and the big dogs out there are going to do it in perpetuity going forward. But you still have the opportunity for others if and when they have their moment to rise, right? Am I framing that correctly?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I would love nothing more than the MLS owners, which, by the way, we said, you know, they met right around the corner here in Los Angeles. And as you mentioned, they've changed some rules. I don't consider them necessarily big, bold, and arrogant to come out tomorrow and say, we're buying USL. It's all being branded MLS from top to finish. We have three different divisions, 1, 2, 3. There is promotion relegation within. There are parachute payments. Everybody is made whole, and it's one big MLS ecosystem going forward. But I also would say that there is a sleeping giant and an existing infrastructure in the college soccer game that has been not untapped, because in the past it was tapped, but now it has almost become obsolete. And I would love to find a way to regenerate that and to use it. And whether it's a feeder system, a developmental type of system, or who knows, maybe it becomes part of that new type of pyramid that you have in when it comes to the level. So there's a lot of creative different things that can be done that don't completely throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to the existing structure, even though some people don't like it out there, but also make it more inclusive, and in doing so, make it more interesting. Because ultimately, this is about attracting people in to watch soccer, to be involved in soccer. And the more interesting that you make it, the more competitive you make it, the more entertaining you make it, and the bigger, I guess, you make it, given relative to how big the United States is and Canada is, the better off you're going to be.
On the topic of college sports, we mentioned this in our last pod, so just to put a ribbon on it, congratulations to the UConn Huskies. They beat Purdue to win the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship. That made some people in our control room very happy. Sean and Kat hate Purdue, so they rooted hard for UConn. And also, Aaron Schechter won her pool by virtue of UConn winning the title.
Question for you now, and I was with Rob Stone carpooling in the other day. Do you consider UConn now a blue blood?
Absolutely.
They absolutely.
Six national titles in 25 years is incredible. They've forced their way into that aristocracy of the sport. They've been more successful than the Kentuckys and Kansas and
but there's
Carolinas.
No official criteria. People just said this is the group of blue bloods, whatever.
Correct.
They'd won a lot and said,
yeah,
all right.
You have your, it's similar to European soccer. You have your Real Madrids and Manchester Uniteds and Bayern Munichs.
Elites.
And
yeah. if
some club that you didn't previously think was on that level all of a sudden won a bunch of Champions League titles, at some point you'd have to say they belong in that group now, and UConn is absolutely
so in this scenario. UConn, I know they're talking football here, but if they did it basketball wise they would be protected from
yes.
any type of relegation
and you know
challenge.
John Calipari left Kentucky to go to Arkansas.
Yes.
Kentucky made a run at UConn's coach Danny Hurley, and he has apparently turned them down. So even more satisfying news for UConn. They're now at the level where their coach is turning down Kentucky.
He stores through and through.
Kentucky is like the okay. Real Madrid of college basketball.
Wow.
So that's
wow.
a pretty big deal.
Times have changed. Times have changed.
Wonder right. what Aaron will do with her winnings. She presumably earned a lot of money by winning this pool.
Well, I mean, usually what you do is you save a portion of it yourself and treat yourself, and I think that's justifiable. And then the rest you usually spend on people that you like and you respect. That limits the pool here, but, you know.
So you and I will not be
no,
getting any
of
gifts.
Of course not. Of course not.
Next up, we have a question on X. Glenton Richards asks, for the expanded Club World Cup in 2025, as host nation, the U.S. is allowed to nominate one team to play in the tournament. In addition to the Seattle Sounders, if you could pick any team for that slot, which would you choose and why?
Oh, man.
Now, typically in the Club World Cup and previous versions of it, the host nation, their reigning domestic champion got that slot. So in MLS's case, it would mean the 2024 MLS Cup winner. But there is this cynicism out there that they want to get Inter Miami in there any way they can. So they're going to wait and see what Inter Miami does this year. If they win the League's Cup or the Supporters Shield or the MLS Cup, whatever they do, MLS will then determine that that's who gets that slot. obviously Inter Miami qualifying by virtue of the CONCACAF Champions Cup went by the wayside last night.
Mm. So this is an interesting question, Glenn. So if my goal is to make the biggest and most positive impact using the platform that is the Club World Cup, and when I say my goal, it would be my MLS goal, right? Because what we talked about earlier, you're looking at Columbus Crew right now as arguably the best team in Major League Soccer. And so from a pure competitive standpoint, they certainly would be a team that I would have no problem inserting into that tournament and being very confident that they would do well and that they would acquit themselves well relative to, you know, their brand, which is Columbus, and the brand of MLS, and I guess by extension, American soccer and certainly American professional soccer. But keep in mind that this is happening a year from now. And whether it's some of the world rule changes that you mentioned earlier, whether it's, I think, an improvement and a continued improvement and a doubling and tripling down when it comes to Inter Miami, I think Inter Miami is going to look very, very different come the summer of 2025. And like it or not, again, don't kill the messenger, but an Inter Miami doing well in the 2025 Club World Cup for the brand of MLS and for American soccer is much more impactful than the Columbus Crew doing well. And I know there's people screaming and yelling right there saying, oh my God, no, but the Columbus Crew can actually win it and Inter Miami can't win it. My point is, I think that they will get to a point where they're a comp for the Columbus Crew. And it's not that the Columbus Crew can't also improve, that I would still feel more comfortable in getting the biggest bang for your buck with a Messi and Inter Miami running around in a Club World Cup. So yes, for the greater good, I would say Inter Miami, I would pick as the team going through. And to your point, I know there's a lot of people from a financial perspective that would love to have that happen.
Yeah, I mean, Glenton is framing it as if they can just pick a team. I think they're going to have to nail down a criteria. I don't think you can just wait and then decide we want to send such and such team. I think they're going to have to determine at some point that it's the MLS Cup winner or the supportership winner.
Yeah.
You know, that you have to have won something, I think, to get
in
there.
Yeah, but if you are sitting in Don Garber's chair and they came to you and said, look, just give us two teams.
Yeah, Inter Miami would for sure be one of them.
Right now, would Seattle be one?
Oh, you're saying even if you just start from scratch.
Yeah, if you're just starting from scratch and say, look, we're having this tournament. You get to send two teams, Don Garber, for the good of your league, doing what's best for your league. Who are the two teams that you're sending?
I think probably Columbus and Inter Miami.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
And by the way, Columbus could qualify if they win this CONCACAF Champions Cup.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
And Philadelphia has a path to getting in. Monterrey won the 2021 CONCACAF Champions League, so they're already in it. If they were to win this edition, then it goes to the next team with the highest coefficient. I read somewhere that that would be Philadelphia. So if you're a Philadelphia fan, you're rooting for Monterrey right now.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's right. All right. I guess. Strange things. But look, good question there, Glenton. I appreciate it. And let us know what you think of Glenton's question. What two teams or what one team, but given that Seattle's going, would you pick if you were in charge in order to make the biggest impact, not to satisfy you from an individual perspective, but if you were in that chair and you were able to pick, let us know who you would pick. Anything else, Mossy?
That's it.
All right, let's go to One for the Road. It's the end of our show. And at the end of each and every show, I do give you my One for the Road. We are coming to you on Thursday, April 11th. We woke up today to the news that O.J. Simpson, former football player, former TV personality, actor, all that kind of stuff, and I guess now a former murderer, passed away. For those that remember, back in 1994, O.J. Simpson was in the low-speed Bronco chase as he was allegedly running from the law, from this craziness that he was involved with. It overlaps with so many different sports stories, including yours truly and the U.S. men's national team that at the time was getting ready to kick off the 1994 World Cup. Keep in mind, the 1994 World Cup was in the United States. For the U.S., our first game was in Detroit, in my old stomping grounds, about 15 minutes away from where I grew up. And it was at the Pontiac Silverdome. So, the night of the chase, if you will, the Bronco chase was, and the Bronco chase happened on June 18th, if I'm not mistaken, 1994. June 17th. I want to make sure I get this right. We played on the 18th, but the Bronco chase was the night before, which was on June 17th, 1994. That night, we were all in our hotel room getting ready for the next day when we're going to play a World Cup game. And we all finish our meal. We head back to our rooms. And word is out. We're watching on our television that this chase is happening. Now, keep in mind, the game is not only the next day, but it is at 11 a.m. in the morning in order to accommodate European time. So that's an early game, early kick, which means that we have to get up early, which means we're trying to go to bed as early as we could, but it was impossible. The entire country was just sitting there in front of their televisions watching this slow speed chase in the Bronco happen on all the California freeways, including those of us that were on the team. At the time, as we all know, I was a roommate of Eric Winalda. I was the only one that could put up with him on the team. But the day before, he had a bottle of a sports drink that shall remain nameless, and he had an allergic reaction. They didn't know if it was the sports drink or anything, and so they were worried that he would infect me with whatever he had. And so they put him in a single room, and I went and roomed with Brad Friedel, our former colleague, wonderful goalkeeper. And I'll never forget sitting with laying down in our double beds there in Pontiac, Michigan, and watching this Bronco chase happen like so many millions were also across the country, and looking at the clock and then looking at the television, looking at the clock and saying, son of a, this is going to keep me from getting the sleep that I need before the biggest game of my life, the World Cup the next day. Now, this was such a convergence of so many different things, including many things in the sports world, that ESPN has an incredible documentary that documents all of the things that were happening at that moment or getting ready to happen. The World Cup had already kicked off. But when I think of O.J. Simpson and I think of that Bronco chase, I think of sitting there next to Brad Friedel, watching it up in Pontiac, Michigan, getting ready to go and play our game that next morning. It's something I can never forget. And I know for an entire generation, it's one of those moments where you know exactly where you were when that was happening.
Just to correct you on something, you called him a murderer. He was found not guilty, actually.
Oh, that's true. Okay, well, to each their own.
But I did get invited by a friend today to an event tomorrow night at the Egyptian Theater. It's the 15-year anniversary of ESPN launching the 30 for 30 series.
Really?
So there's going to be a panel with a bunch of filmmakers and ESPN execs, and they're going to show clips from several 30 for 30s, including the one you just alluded to, the June 17, 1994 one. So I'm thinking of going to this because it's going to be pretty interesting now in the wake of OJ passing away. But yeah, that was an incredible sports day. You had the Bronco chase. You had Knicks-Rockets NBA Finals. You had the New York Rangers parade after they won the Stanley Cup. You had the start of the World Cup. You had Arnold Palmer playing his final round at the U.S. Open. Ken Griffey Jr. hit 3 home runs in a Major League Baseball game. So yeah, and ESPN did an incredible job of capturing all that. To me, that's like a top 5 30 for 30 for me, along with like the two Escobars, and there's a couple others. But
well, I mean, the actual O.J. documentary, I think, is one of the great ones in history.
Absolutely. O.J. Made in America. Yeah. That's the greatest thing ESPN has ever done. It's one of the best.
Incredible.
It transcends sports. It's one of the best documentaries, period, I've ever watched.
I couldn't. I mean, I talk about binging. I just could not stop watching that. That was insane. My goodness. Anything before we go, Mossy?
That is it.
All right. Well, thank you for hanging with us today and getting through all this this craziness on and off the field. We appreciate that you're downloading and reviewing and watching and rating and doing all the different things, whether you're listening to it in your car or whether you're watching it on Spotify or YouTube out there on all the different platforms. We thank you for doing that. If you want to get in touch with us, as we mentioned, you can use that Ask Alexi hashtag on social media or our State of the Union podcast hotline, which again is 657-549-2297, 657-549-2297. Have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy all the soccer on and off the field or whatever you're doing out there. And we'll talk to you again next week. And until then, and as always, my friends, size the damn.